when newspapers disappear, all of the reporting that they provided also disappears. So you get to the point where the news product that's being presented to the audience doesn't have as much local content because there just aren't enough local reporters. So people don't know what's happening in their local communities because it's all been cut back. Local political contests are not so much about local issues anymore because it's hard for people to even get information. So they all become nationalized.
You're listening to St. Pete X. Today's episode is brought to you by Cityverse. Cityverse brings the community together on a new civic platform powered by Catalyst News. St. Pete Cityverse is launching soon. You can learn more and reserve your home space at cityverse.life. Now, enjoy the conversation. Joining me on SPX is Eric Deggans, who is many things, including a media critic for NPR.
Technically, TV critic. And media analyst and guest host for NPR.
Guest host too, yeah. And you've guest hosted quite a few things. That's kind of fun.
It is. It's a different set of skills other than being a critic or being a reporter, particularly at NPR. You know, when you're a guest host, you're essentially doing a lot of long-form interviews about a lot of different things. And so it's cool to get a chance to talk to people over a longer period of time and then also kind of test your knowledge of everything from, you know, events in Lebanon, which we'll be talking about this weekend, to, you know, an in-depth interview with musician John Batiste about reinventing classical music on his latest record. It's a wide gamut.
It just happened about 10 minutes ago.
Yeah, it happened. Yeah, it literally like 15 minutes ago.
So let's, what are the logistics of that? I mean, you've guest hosted quite a few different shows on different networks. You know, how do they come to you? They just say, hey, let's see if Eric's available. They call you.
Well, you know, I think at NPR, it is viewed as a way to allow you to do some different kinds of things. So, you know, part of it, I think, is them being aware that you would be willing to do something like that as a way to kind of spread your wings and do something different and add to what you're known for. And then I think part of it, too, is, you know, we are small but mighty, right? Mm-hmm. We had some staff reductions, and so everybody's trying to do more with less. And so when people go on vacation, you know, sometimes it is a little tougher to find somebody who can fill in for them. So I think both of those things kind of came into play in terms of me guest hosting. The first time I did it, for All Things Considered, over the weekend, they were between hosts. You know, Michelle Martin had left for Morning Edition, and they hadn't really figured out who was going to take over the show full time. They wound up hiring Scott Detrow to do it. But in between that was when I got slotted in to do some guest hosting last year. And then in this case, you know, it's the Thanksgiving week that we're talking. And then the next time I'm going to do it will be the Saturday after New Year's. So people are on vacation. A lot of people are gone. And it's sort of like, well, who can we get to sort of fill in? But, I appreciate it because, again, like I said, you know, I don't get a chance to do long-form interviews as often in my main job, which is reviewing television and doing trend stories and things like that. And so getting a chance to sort of sit down with, you know, I sat down with the director of this documentary about yacht rock mm-hmm. for about 40 minutes. And it was so much fun because I'm actually a fan of that kind of music. And we got a chance to sort of defend it and talk about why it's not just, you know, pointless schlock or overly saccharine, you know, pop. And so you get to delve into some things in a way that you normally wouldn't if you're just working as a reporter or a correspondent or even a critic or an analyst at NPR. So that was that. I've guest hosted CNN's Reliable Sources, and there they were between hosts as well. They hadn't hired Brian Stelter yet, and Howie Kurtz had left, and they needed somebody to fill in. So I did that for 3 weeks. And then, you know, I guest hosted Florida This Week, the local politics show, a couple of times at the end of last year. And that was because Rob Lori needed a break, and he's an old friend. And so, sure, you know, I'll step in and help out. So usually it's some combination of they need somebody and they're wondering if I'm willing to spread my wings or stretch my talents a little bit, and I'm usually up for it.
They say Christopher Cross was the first victim of the music video. he was doing all right until he had to be seen on camera, and then his popularity.
Yeah, a lot of people have said that. But also I think, and you know, not to get too into it, but the doc kind of makes this clear. You know, Christopher Cross had a ton of success.
Yeah.
And, you know, they played like Ride Like the Wind, and they played Sailin, and they played Arthur's Theme on the radio like constantly. Mm-hmm. And I just think part of it too was that people kind of got tired of that sound, and they rejected a lot of artists that they thought were sort of emblematic of it. So, you know, Christopher Cross got rejected and Toto got rejected and, you know, Kenny Loggins had to start doing movie themes. And, you know, a lot of the people that were sort of viewed and, you know, fortunately, some of the people like the Doobie Brothers just basically pivoted back to being more of a biker rock kind of country rock kind of thing. And Michael McDonald pivoted towards his R&B roots and did, you know, much more sort of funky R&B, contemporary, you know, R&B kind of records. But everybody had to scatter because people just kind of got tired of that sound. And you know, a lot of artists paid the price for it.
So when you do so many different things, and, you know, we'll get into your work in ethics, your work on race, obviously media, film, you pivoted from music into television at the Times. What is sort of your conscious understanding, management, whatever you want to call it, of your personal brand and your philosophy between, you know, going deep into one thing, you know, versus having a varied, you know, widely different skill set and employment set?
Well, I think, and I really sort of think my journey is sort of emblematic of the journey that a lot of journalists have taken in the modern age, because we're in this area where technology allows you to do a lot more. You know, 15 or 20 years ago, it would have been much harder for me to work for the national NPR network and live in St. Petersburg, Florida. But because we have the kind of online technology that we have, and we have the kind of, you know, recording technology and audio technology that we have, a lot of people don't know that I don't live in D.C. or I don't live in New York or I don't live in L.A. So the technology has kind of met the moment. Now, the other thing that's happened, of course, is that media has become a much less secure business. It's become harder to make a buck in a lot of ways. And it's also become harder for big media institutions to say to employees, we will be everything to you. You know, there was a time when big newspapers like the New York Times or the Washington Post would seriously frown on staffers doing other things like hosting a TV show or writing a screenplay that gets produced by a TV outlet or guest hosting something, because they wanted to be very proprietary. And they wanted to say, you know, if you're going to have the imprimatur of the New York Times, we're going to take care of, we want to receive everything that you do as a media person. And we don't want the competition or somebody who's not part of our corporate framework to benefit from it. But things have just progressed to the point where it is not possible for media outlets to say that to employees now, because they don't have the capacity to necessarily compensate you for that stuff. And it doesn't make sense. You know, NPR has some video stuff, but it's not a TV outlet. So if I get the chance to guest host Reliable Sources, they're not going to say, well, we have a Reliable Sources you should be hosting. They don't do it. So they were cool enough to say, okay, it helps us to have your brand on CNN, to have you presented as an authority, guest hosting the show. I did it like, I think maybe 2 or 3 months after I was named TV critic at NPR. So there was already a fair amount of publicity around me taking the job. And ultimately, it helped both our brands. So I think part of what you're doing is you're going to the places where your primary employment is, and you're saying, look, if you let me do outside work, it helps both our brands. And you have to make sure that your employer understands that and is supportive of that, because otherwise there can be a lot of friction and it can be hard to hold on to your primary job. I've been lucky both at the Tampa Bay Times and at NPR. You know, I sort of came to both of those outlets already doing a lot of things they understood, that it was better to let me push my brand wherever there were opportunities, and that, you know, because our brands were commingled, it would help their brand as well. So now with NPR, you know, when I go on CNN, when I go on MSNBC, even when I go on WEDU or when I do a podcast like this, they understand that NPR's brand is reaching people. And if they like what I have to say, or just intrigued by what I have to say, then maybe they'll seek me out on one of NPR's products, which is where I spend most of my professional time. And fortunately, you know, the business has progressed to the point where you just don't have to have those kind of conversations that much anymore. You know, I'll let my superiors know what's going on. If they have a problem, we can talk through it. Usually they don't. They just need to know what I'm doing, and then it's off to the races and I can try something else as long as it doesn't interfere with me doing my core job well, which so far it hasn't.
And so that's the logistics element of it.
Sure.
What about the actual brand strategy? You know, I know you're a fan of Roger Ebert. Could Roger Ebert have been Roger Ebert if he was, you know, doing 50 different things, or to get to the top of that heap, do you need to do
Well, I mean, it's interesting that you would use Roger Ebert as an example, because he's one of the first journalists to actually do this kind of stuff. He was primarily the movie critic for the Chicago Sun-Times. And indeed, you know, I grew up in Gary, Indiana, which is just 40 minutes from Chicago. And I grew up reading his work, and that's how I became a fan. But he also had a TV show that was syndicated on PBS stations called Sneak Previews with Gene Siskel. And that's what turned him into a nationwide celebrity, more than just writing for the Sun-Times. Well, he was a movie critic.
Yeah.
So he was critiquing movies for the Sun-Times. Then he came up with this idea where they would create a TV show where his biggest rival, the movie critic for the Chicago Tribune, would sit with him in a movie theater and they would debate movies. And that became a TV show, which is different than writing for a newspaper. And then he also did books. So he was an author. And eventually he had a very well-regarded website that has survived his death, called RogerEbert.com. And, you know, he also executive produced a documentary about his life. So, you know, he did a bunch of stuff too. He acted in movies.
Yeah.
You know, I think what you have to do is you have to get a sense of what you want to spend your time doing. What do you find most fulfilling in your work? Particularly if you're someone like me, if you're a journalist, you know, it sounds like a highfalutin title, but this is how I see myself. If you're like a thought leader in an area, I basically decided to become an expert on media, on how media intersects with race and racial dynamics, and then also music, because I've been a musician for 40 years. And I was signed to a major, I was in a band that was signed to a major label when I was in college. I was signed to Motown. And I supported myself as a musician for years. So I understand pop music. I understand the world of music. I understand media. I understand race. And so I've tried to become an authority on those things and how they intersect and how they work in modern society. And then it's sort of like, well, what platform can I express that on? Do I express it? And where can I sort of make a living expressing, you know, what I think about these things? So, you know, I've written a book, and that book has gone into, it's gone into classrooms. It's become a textbook for some media analysis classes. So I've also taught, because I have a book that can be used as a teaching tool. So, you know, I teach as an adjunct at Duke University and at Indiana University. I talk a lot on television because that's a good way to disseminate ideas, and they always need an expert to come on and talk about things. So then, you know, you go on CNN enough and they sort of say, I'd been a guest on Reliable Sources when Howie Kurtz hosted it many times. And so they say, well, hey, you want to take a shot at guest hosting it while we look for another host? Sure, I'd be glad to do it. So part of it is knowing what you find fulfilling, what you want to really explore as a thought leader, as a journalist, as a writer, as someone who tries to put ideas out there and make connections. And then you take advantage of the opportunities as they present themselves, and you try to move towards things that make sense, and you try to avoid things that don't make sense. But a lot of this is not necessarily planned. It's about understanding what you find fulfilling and what you can earn a living doing, and then letting those things kind of make the choices for you. And then occasionally just taking a leap of faith.
Makes sense. Yeah, when I was, you know, when I was thinking of Roger Ebert, I know he did a lot of things, but it was all around movies, right? So it was a specific and
sort of movies and pop culture, yeah. And eventually he wound up talking about television too. I mean, it's, you know, it's all of a piece. He was too brilliant a writer to just be limited to movies, and he often was.
Right. And you mentioned, you know, good for you, good for NPR and the brand. You know, because there's so many people out there with their voices in the world now, maybe distribution has risen above brand sometimes and become a more important element.
Sure. And, you know, there's a certain, I mean, the other thing is, like, given what kind of message that you put out there, there is an audience that will be receptive to it or not receptive to it. And I think, you know, what a lot of people in media are learning right now is what people already knew in AM radio, what people already knew in cable TV, which is, you know, the white male demographic is a very powerful demographic. It's a demographic that's sizable. It's a demographic that responds to certain kind of messages in a very, you know, distinct way. And it's a demographic that can be very lucrative if you find the right people to sort of speak to it. And, you know, so Rush Limbaugh did it in the 80s when he invented his talk show, where he talked about politics in a way that was different than anybody on the air was talking about it at the time. And Fox News did it with television when they figured out how to talk about the news in a way that was different than anybody talked about it. And now we're seeing it with podcasters like Joe Rogan, who are talking about life and talking about society in a way that, again, appeals to white males. Hmm. And so I guess it's because Americans in particular, we're not as aware of our history as we should be. And I do feel like this is a cycle that has been constantly repeating itself. If you look at media over the years, you can trace it all the way back to radio shows that were led by, you know, people won't know these names, but, you know, a guy like Bob Grant, who was a well-known talk show host in New York in the 60s and 70s, or Joe Pyne, who was a well-known talk show host in California in the 50s and 60s. You know, this idea of galvanizing an audience by speaking to conservative white men has a very, very long history in this country. And so to see it rise in podcasting should not be that much of a surprise to people, because it's happened in just about every other media outlet you can think about.
And is this kind of connected to a term you use, the tyranny of the broad niche?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So in my book, Race Baiter, which came out in 2012, I talk about this idea of the tyranny of the broad niche. And I was using it, you know, Fox News was what made me think of it first, which is when you're in a fractured media environment, the people who can draw the biggest tiny piece of that environment are the ones who do well. So Fox News was able to say, and I don't know how deliberate this was. I think it was somewhat deliberate, but basically Roger Ailes, the man who invented Fox News, looked at cable TV news and said, you know, most of the people who watch cable TV news are older, they're white, they're politically conservative. So if I create a channel that speaks to them, then, you know, I'll get more viewers than somebody who's trying to be quote unquote objective and not really speaking directly to what they fear, to what they hope, to what they believe. And so he created it because he was a middle-aged white conservative white guy. He created a channel that was in his own image, and he stocked it with people that would appeal to him. And because he was an expert producer, he'd been executive producer of the Mike Douglas Show back in the 1960s and left that to be a media advisor for Richard Nixon. He knew television, and so he knew how to create compelling television and marry that with a message that was aimed right at middle-aged conservative white men and the women who love them. And, you know, you have Fox News, and it's become a juggernaut that has changed the political landscape even to today.
So that strategy, though, the cat's kind of out of the bag on that strategy. So has it been recreated and effectively in other niches and in other for other demographics?
Well, I think the challenge that you run into, I mean, yes, it has been recreated for other demographics. And sometimes when you're speaking to those other demographics, politics is not necessarily the unifying force that brings people together. So you look at somebody like Oprah, and what Oprah Winfrey was able to do, and Phil Donahue before her, was craft a message on television that spoke directly to middle-aged women, and mostly middle-aged white women. You know, they were mostly white. So, you know, Oprah built a billion-dollar fortune, a multi-billion-dollar fortune, on creating a TV product that spoke directly to that audience. And that audience stayed loyal to her into her creating a magazine, her creating a cable channel with her own name, and then leaving both of those ventures, you know, leaving active management of both those ventures to sort of become a free agent who does these high impact interviews at places like CBS. So yeah, it is absolutely possible. You look at, you know, Club Shay Shay, and you see what's happening there. That is a podcast that's directed at black people, particularly black males. And you look at The Breakfast Club, the morning DJs who also have a podcast and a video cast of the interviews that they do. And you look at Charlamagne Tha God's, you know, he's a member of that crew, and he's developed his own sort of side career where he's an author and he's a public speaker, and he hosted a show on Comedy Central. And so it is, of course, possible to find other parts of the fractured landscape and target those niches and make a lot of money targeting those niches. But I think what everybody's paying attention to right now is white males, because the platforms that are targeting that demographic have had a tremendous political impact in the last month or so. And people are still trying to figure out what it all means for media, what it all means for politics, what it all means for society.
Yeah, I definitely want to touch on that. When you think about these broad niches, there are certain elements of commonality, obviously being white, I mean, being male, but, you know, with Oprah, slightly different, you know, it was female, but, you know, but I think you could segment it even further. So, you know, what's the difference between, I don't know, best way to say it, healthy and unhealthy attributes that you can push buttons on to build, you know, to build a brand, to build a product, to serve a demographic?
Well, you know, as a media critic, whenever I'm looking at messaging, the things I'm always asking is, you know, is this messaging rooted in some kind of toxicity? Is it homophobic? Is it transphobic? Is it sexist? Is it racist? So, you know, when you think about Rush Limbaugh, you think about Fox News, you think about Joe Rogan, all of those platforms kind of fail that test right away, right? They are filled with misinformation and disinformation. They are filled with troubling ideas about immigrants, troubling ideas about women, and troubling ideas about people of color, especially black people. So that's the first thing I sort of do is there a toxicity sort of embedded in the messaging? The second thing I would ask is it being dishonest with the audience? What some of this messaging also does is it's not honest with its audience about facts. It's not honest with its audience about its motivation for even doing things. When Fox News presents a roundtable discussion about X issue, are they taking on that issue because the people who are executive producers of the show thought that it was one of the most important issues they could tackle in that moment? Or are they tackling it because there's some sort of political or social goal that they have, and that's why they're tackling it? You know, there's a reason why so many elements of Fox News kept echoing the lie that Donald Trump told, that he did not lose the 2020 election. He absolutely lost that election fair and square. There were more than 60 court decisions that backed that up. But still and yet, Fox News, which is supposed to be a cable news channel, had personalities on the air constantly insisting that it wasn't true, that Donald Trump did not lose that election. And so are you looking at a platform and seeing that it is actively lying to the audience regularly? That's why I don't like a lot of reality, quote unquote, reality TV shows. I think that's a misnomer. And you can't even call them unscripted TV shows because some of them have scripts. But, you know, these shows that are supposedly taking people who are not professional performers, putting them in contrived situations and then creating TV shows out of what happened. And that's everything from The Bachelor to Survivor to The Kardashians to whatever you want to name. Those shows are not honest with the viewers about how they come together, about how contrived the situations are, about whether people are reacting honestly or whether they're reading from some kind of script or whether they're following some kind of plan, or how the thing was edited after it was filmed. And was it edited in a way that was misleading and that, you know, made it look like things happened in a certain sequence when they didn't happen in that sequence? There's a famous saying in reality TV, "I didn't come here to make friends." You know, we hear people who go on these shows say that all the time. I believe it was inspired by something that happened on The Bachelor. I reviewed this wonderful history of reality TV called Cue the Sun by Emily Nussbaum, who's a TV critic for New York Magazine. And she tracked down the genesis of the saying, and it turns out that it was an unethically edited soundbite from a reality TV show, and the person who said it did not mean that when she said it. And to me, that just sort of sums up reality TV in that the signature phrase that everyone associates with reality TV shows was something that was part of what we call a Frankenbite, where they took a part of a phrase that someone said in one conversation and another part of a phrase that someone said in a different conversation, and they edited it together to make it seem like that person expressed that complete thought in one way. And so, you know, you look as a media critic, you look at the messaging, you say, okay, is it toxic? Okay, is it honest with its audience or is it lying to them all the time? And then finally, does it take responsibility for its impact on the audience, on society, on everything, right? If you create a cable TV news channel that allows people to pretend that a politician didn't lose a fair election, that people who attacked the Capitol building didn't actually attack police officers or break into the building or spread defecation on the walls and look to hang the vice president and the Speaker of the House. If you create a cable news channel that allows people to deny the truth of those things, then you have to say that is a dangerous and damaging impact. So again, as a media critic, I'm saying, is there a toxic message? Is the platform being honest with its viewers or audience? And then finally, is it owning up to the impact of what it's doing? And so if you use that yardstick to judge a lot of these platforms, you can figure out whether they're positive or not, whether they're negative or not, whether they're worth supporting or not, and whether they deserve criticism or not.
You know, thinking about marketing, creating demand, making you hungry so you buy the food or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, applying that lens to these outlets, why does it work? Is it that they are, you know, they know certain attributes that they're just pressing those buttons to create, you know, in the case of immigration, you know, fear and rage and whatnot. But, you know, why are people tuning into Oprah? But more importantly, why are people tuning into Fox News? Why are they tuning into Joe Rogan? Why does it work?
Well, you find out what your target audience cares about, what they fear, what they hope, and you create programming that targets those things. And you create programming that targets those things in a communication style that the target audience will respond to. So the target audience for Fox News is going to respond to a message that's delivered with urgency, that's delivered with sex appeal, that's delivered with sizzle and flash. In the case of Oprah, she was delivering her message, particularly as the show matured and it was trying to find a way to distinguish itself from all the other talk shows that were around at the time, they decided to center their message on being uplifting and being positive and telling the audience that this show, watching this show, will improve your life. It will teach you how to be a better person. It will teach you how to help other people be better as well. And we'll all be on this ride together. And we'll be the kind of posse that gathers in book clubs. We'll be the kind of posse that shows up at live events. The first time I interviewed Oprah, she came to Tampa because her Live Your Best Life tour came to the Tampa Convention Center in 2002. And I interviewed her right before the first day started. And so for the female audience, it's about creating a community that people want to be a part of. It's about making them feel like they will improve themselves by participating in the messaging, by taking it in, by watching the show, by buying the products, by going to the live events, and being a much more sort of positive and uplifting message. Whereas, you know, a lot of Fox News's message is about, here's what you should be afraid of, here's some of the terrible things happening in the world, and here's who you should blame for it. The message is delivered by people who the audience will either identify with because they see themselves in them, people like Sean Hannity or Bill O'Reilly, or delivered by people that they find attractive, you know, Laura Ingraham or Megyn Kelly. So part of it is the message, part of it is how you deliver the message, but all of it is about how that group prefers to communicate. What's the most effective way of reaching them? And that's why people who are on the outside of that dynamic have a hard time understanding why that kind of communication is so successful, and they have a hard time figuring out how to disrupt it. You know, I think, you know, Donald Trump is obviously someone who's sort of immersed himself in Fox News's communication style. And it's not like, you know, he has some sort of PhD in communication studies and decided, hey, I'm going to watch how they do things and I'm going to craft a political career around it. He very instinctively, as a longtime watcher of Fox News, saw what they were doing and found a way to create a version of it for himself, with himself at the center, where his communication with people who are attracted to him short circuits any attempt to try to speak against that or try to deliver a counter message, because he knows how to communicate with his core audience, with his base, in a way that they respond to the strongest. And I think one of the challenges that traditional media has had and that traditional politicians have had in trying to challenge some of his messages is that in the past, traditional journalists find out the facts, they reveal them in a story, they show it to the audience, and they say, this is what we found out. You decide how you feel about it. And, you know, if you prove somebody was lying, you prove that what they say wasn't true, you prove that they have a history of lying, you think, well, that's all I have to do, right? To have people assume that this person is a liar and maybe they shouldn't trust what they say. But when you show that to someone who is heavily invested in believing the person because that person is telling them what they want to hear and they are telling them that in a way that speaks exactly to how they want to be talked to, you can't disrupt that connection by just coming up with a bunch of true facts and saying, here's what seems to be really going on. It's not enough. And we learn that you know, in this election. We learned that in the run-up to this election. We learned that in the fact that Donald Trump still has a political career. I mean, you know, I think people are still amazed that a guy who lied about losing an election, who had people who worked for him, they're still facing legal consequences for supporting his lies. You know, Fox News had to pay a $787 million judgment because they had too many people on their airwaves saying that Dominion Voting Systems was part of some grand conspiracy to deny Donald Trump the election in 2020, to say nothing of the aides who went to jail, to say nothing, you know, Rudy Giuliani is going to wind up destitute because he attacked election workers who sued him and won a tremendous judgment against him. But somehow Donald Trump remains unscathed. And he just got reelected to the presidency. And people are scratching their heads trying to figure out, how did somebody who, you know, fomented a movement that wound up attacking the Capitol building, wound up creating an incident where several people died, wound up denying that he lost a free and fair election in a way that caused supporters of his to pay millions of dollars in damages, and yet His political career seemed sort of unfazed, and he's now been reelected to the presidency. And I think a central reason for that is that he has been able to establish, in a unique way, in a way that's not necessarily transferable to anyone else, a strong bond with the people who support him. And he communicates with them in a way that's really hard to disrupt and really hard to sort of wake people up from.
I certainly think a big element of that is with the intermingling of news, opinion, information, and your personality on social media. Now people's identity are wrapped up in the tribes they belong to. And so they're not looking at a news station and saying, I'm receiving this information. Some of it I buy, some of it I don't. It's actually really hard to bifurcate out what you agree with and what you don't agree with, lest you be, you know, feel less included in the tribe. And so, you know, when you have your family telling you something, you know, as we've seen throughout history, you'll believe almost anything they say because they're your family. And now ideology or, you know, being, you know, invested in Donald Trump is so tied to their identities, they just can't, they don't let go of it.
I mean, what I would say is that's always been the case. That has always been the case. But we are now in a media environment that is so fractured that it is not possible for the dominant culture to so completely dominate news or so completely dominate entertainment or so completely dominate pop culture in the way white culture could dominate in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. You know, it's not possible. So it is easier in some ways to see the tribalism because the increasing agency of non-white people in America have made those fault lines like much more obvious. Mm-hmm. You know, when black people were segregated into second-class housing and second-class schools and second-class media, white people never had to be aware that there was another way to see things like the civil rights movement in the 1960s or the draft for Vietnam or housing, the way housing is apportioned and who's allowed to move into what neighborhoods or how police treat people who live in one neighborhood versus how they treat people who live in another. I mean, one of the ways in which, you know, systemic racism hit the international stage is that somebody held up a phone and took an 8-minute video of a black man being strangled to death by a cop. And finally, people said, oh, well, I guess there must be something to this police brutality thing. We have an 8-minute video of a police officer ignoring a crowd, asking him to let the guy breathe. And he keeps his neck on the guy, his knee on the guy's neck until he dies. And, you know, that's not the first time that had happened. It's not the first time a white police officer unfairly killed an unarmed black man, but it was the first time that it was captured on video in a way that took flight internationally within hours. And so when you have a situation where marginalized people have access to media like that, then the dominant culture needs to act more aggressively to try to assert its control. And so we find Fox News and other conservative-oriented media outlets becoming much more extremist and advocating positions that I think even people who worked at Fox News, say 15 years ago or 20 years ago when it was first founded, would not necessarily support. But it's all part of this dance where, you know, different elements of society feel threatened by the emergence and growing agency of certain other elements. And so they become radicalized and their media outlets talk about it in a certain way and so on and so forth and so on and so forth. And so, you know, we're in the middle of a period of intense backlash, I think, against efforts to talk about systemic racism, talk about trans identity, talk about homophobia and sexism, to talk about all these things that have been at the heart of how America has operated for hundreds of years. But we're putting them, thanks to our modern media technology, we're putting them on the table in a way that is tough to ignore. And so that's radicalized the counter message, and now here we are. And, you know, I don't know where all of this is going to go. I don't know how the story ends. But I do know that it's a constant cycle. And if you're not aware of how history works, if you haven't looked at how we've talked about issues in the 60s and in the 50s and in the 40s and in the 30s and the 20s and the 10s and the 1800s, if you're not aware of how America changed right after the Civil War and then how it changed again when the Southern states figured out how to nudge northern states into allowing them to subjugate black people again through Jim Crow laws, then, you know, you're not aware of the cycle of America's turbulence over these issues. It's a very long cycle that has repeated itself again and again and again, where you have progress and backlash and progress and backlash. And right now we're in the middle of a pretty intense period of backlash, and it's tough to know when that ends or where we go next.
So through that lens, it's not even that Roger Ailes was a broadcast genius. It's simply the natural, you know, Fox News couldn't have existed 50 years ago because it didn't need to. And now it's the natural backlash of a demographic trying to hold on to power.
Well, I guess what I would say is that Fox News, I mean, there was what Fox News is now was just the news back then.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Amos and Andy was an incredibly popular radio show that was on the air for decades. And it was two white guys pretending to be incredibly dim-witted and lazy black men. So, I mean, do we have any equivalent like that now? I don't think so. I think we've at least reached a point where we don't have that, right? But that was, I mean, that was a pop culture hit back in the day, right? So what I would say is it's taking a different form. In some ways, it seems to be a little more extremist. In some ways, it's embracing things because of the current circumstance. For example, you know, some conservatives have come to embrace strongmen like Vladimir Putin, where in the 60s and 70s, you know, in the 70s, if you were to go to Richard Nixon and say, you know, in 40 years, the Republican Party is going to have a significant elements of it that think the president of Russia, the authoritarian president of Russia, is an admirable figure. I don't think he would even believe it, you know, because America back then was so anti-communist and so anti-Russia and so committed to the idea that the Soviet Union was our geopolitical foe that I think it'd be hard for people from that time to believe where the Republican Party is now. But you know, things change, and particularly regarding the circumstances of authoritarians trying to hold on to power and people hoping that an authoritarian regime will elevate their point of view and marginalize points of view that they disagree with.
And the reality is that the word, you know, Vladimir Putin doesn't enter, nobody has direct access or knowledge of anything that's happening in Russia other than through the very very thin lens through which they receive their media. And so it's, you know, really up to, it can be somewhat arbitrary as to who's to put up there as a, you know, as long as they represent the ideal that is either they expect to sell something or expect to push an agenda, then they can basically insert anything they want into that space.
Well, I mean, I would say that the value of somebody like Navalny is that he was the public face of a band of, I don't know, insurgents, rebels, people who opposed Putin, who were committed to the ideas of trying to report the truth of what was happening inside Russia and inside countries that Russia controls, and trying to talk about the truth of how their leaders live and how their leaders do business. So I wouldn't say that it's impossible to find out what's going on in Russia. You can't go to, you know, the dominant mainstream news outlet in Russia and feel like you know exactly what's going on there unless you know how to decode their propaganda and ideological distortions. But there are people inside Russia who are committed to trying to get the word out about what's happening in that country. And you can find them on social media and you can see their work in films and in books. It is possible to know. It's just very difficult because it's an authoritarian regime that has not been shy about assassinating people who oppose it.
Yeah, and I know I meant more that people just aren't going to look for that. They're just going to take whatever's given to them through those couple lenses that they tend to just listen to every day or read every day. And so they're not out seeking that kind of information.
Are you talking about Americans?
Yeah, just, you know, the people that are comfortably in the broad niche, right? They're comfortable.
Yeah, that may be true. I think there's a lot of people who want to believe what Tucker Carlson tells them about Russia and Putin. They want to believe, you know, what some of these other commentators tell them. And so they may accept that messaging. But it is possible to hear a wide range of reporting or a wide range of accounts about what's happening there. And it doesn't take that much effort to do it. So it is possible for people to hear the truth if they're willing to look for it a little bit.
I also think that what the internet brought is an explosion of information, infinite expertise. You know, if you're into something, you can go find 100 hours of it or a million hours of it on YouTube or whatever. And so it's, sure. You know, the average journalist sometimes finds it hard to, you know, distill that information in a compelling way. But I think what that's also done is overwhelmed a lot of people and made proxies more valuable. And so, you know, why Tucker Carlson makes sense is like, I like Tucker, I trust him, I'll just listen to him and I can save myself a lot of work.
Well, and also he's entertaining and he's presenting the world the way I expect it to be or the way I fear it might be. There's a lot of reasons. But I also think that, you know, when we had this information technology come along, in the beginning, there was a sense that, wow, you know, having a global sense, a global feed of information, you know, people on the front lines of every conflict, people, you know, in France who can post on their own about what's happening in Paris, and I can read it on Facebook or I can see it on TikTok and I don't have to have it filtered by the BBC or you know, a French news agency. There was a lot of appeal to that idea. And I think at first people really enjoyed the idea that there was a lot of information out there that was unmoderated, that was unfiltered, where they felt like they were hearing from much closer to the action than if somebody from CBS or NPR was delivering a report. But what we've now discovered is that, you know, a lot of those people are not necessarily trained in how to vet facts. They're not necessarily trained. You know, when you're a professional journalist and you've covered several wildfires in a row, you understand how in the initial minutes and hours of an emergency, there is a ton of incorrect information that comes flying out of bystanders, out of emergency workers who are on the site, out of agencies that haven't yet figured out what's going on. You get this fountain of misinformation that comes flying at you. And when you gain a little bit of experience, you learn how to sort through that and figure out what might kind of be true, what's less likely to be true, what probably definitely is true. And then when you deliver your reports for NPR or PBS or the New York Times, you know, you sifted through it and you're presenting something that has a higher level of truth to it. Unfortunately, if you're relying on a bunch of, you know, video bloggers who kind of descend on the area and just kind of pass a camera around and then they repeat every rumor that they hear from everyone they encounter, you get this fire hose of disinformation that comes at you. And because you're not trusting, you know, trained journalists to sift through it for you, you are liable to believe things that may not be true. And if you're in a situation where you don't have a lot of skin in the game, if you're in Maine and you're seeing a bunch of reports about a wildfire in California that are wrong, there's not much consequence to you if you wind up believing it. But if people are talking about the pandemic and they're resisting vaccinations because they heard this person had a problem with vaccinations and they heard that person has a problem, and they convince you to not get a vaccination, and then you get COVID and you have ongoing health issues, or you die from it, or you pass it to someone else in your family who dies from it, then all of a sudden that misinformation has a cost. And so we're in this situation where our information framework has matured. And we're not just getting all of these accounts from people at the center of the action. We're getting misinformation and disinformation that's deliberately created by people who have specific goals with it. People in Korea, people in Russia, people in China. They have specific things they want the American people to believe, and they are flooding the zone with misinformation and disinformation. And beyond that, we have people who just like to cause trouble, who are putting a bunch of misinformation and disinformation out there. And beyond that, we have well-meaning people who are just wrong, and they're putting a bunch of information out there. And then you have a public who's grown so cynical about traditional media and so distrustful that they are much more willing to believe some video blogger who's saying something that sounds like it might be true to them than, you know, go on social media and send a message to somebody like me and say, hey, is this happening? And I can say, well, you know, as a journalist, I've done some research and this is what I think is happening. You know, one of the things that we have talked about enough in terms of thinking about social media is that it destroys the value of expertise. It destroys the appreciation for expertise. When you create a platform where everyone has an equal say, regardless of how much they know about a subject, then it puts the people who spent 30 or 40 years studying a subject on the same level as people who heard about it yesterday. And so I find myself a lot of times getting into debates with people on social media where I have to say, look, I've been covering television since 1997. I've been a journalist since 1990. Before that, I was a musician that was signed to Motown. So I know about the music industry. I know about the TV industry. I know about journalism. I've been studying and acting and behaving in these worlds for decades. I might know a little bit of what I'm talking about here. And you have to go round and round with some people sometimes and constantly say, well, what you think is not true because of this, and what you think is not true because of that. And you can go round and round and you can disprove every sort of cockamamie notion they have. But in the end, they are convinced that because they believe something intensely, it must be true. And that is what we have wrought, both with social media and with the extremism that we've seen in some areas of politics. People think that because they believe it intensely, it must be true, regardless of how much information you pile up to show them that it's not.
So how do you see the trajectory of this evolution of information going? You talk about us being sort of in a mature environment. You know, at some point there'll be ideally consequences, whether it's just pure scattered misery or just, you know, some misinformation that actually, you know, causes thousands of people to die or whatever. You know, is there going to be a reckoning for this, or how do you see us coming out the other side of this in the next decade?
I mean, it would seem that one reason why Donald Trump lost the election in 2020 was because of the pandemic, a pandemic that killed a million people. And yet when he ran for re-election, his supporters seemed to shrug off the notion that, you know, he was president for months as this pandemic unfolded and presented a ton of mixed messages about how people should react to it. And at one point went on the air and told people to inject themselves with bleach and told them to use medications that seemed to have a limited impact on the virus. And then later when he got COVID, wasn't transparent about when he got it, how he got it, how long he suffered from it, how much of a physical toll it might have taken on him. So it's tough to imagine what consequence can come along that's greater than a pandemic that kills a million people, or a candidate for office who, you know, incites a movement that leads to a physical attack on the Capitol building. It is just really hard to imagine what sort of consequence could be bigger than that to shake people and make them rethink what they're doing. So I really don't know where things might go on that scale. What I do think ultimately needs to happen for journalists, though, is that we need to find new ways of reaching people. And we need to find a way to sort of rebuild public confidence in what we're doing. And doubling down on our past strategies of we'll just find the facts and we'll just present them to you and we'll let you figure out what they mean, that's not working. So we have to figure out a way to sort of tell the kind of stories that will get people to pay attention to the facts, the true facts that we discover, vet, and then present to people. And I think that's going to be a long process. It's going to take a lot of time. And news outlets will be under attack from people who want to compromise further the public trust in what they report because it makes things easier for them. So I think that's the battle that we're in for over the next couple of years is attempts by more traditional journalists to rebuild the trust that they once had with their audience, and then while also fending off attacks from people who are trying to delegitimize them.
To that point, you know, the cult of personality with Trump, do you think it's as much a degradation? You know, you talk about the big three networks back in the day. It was three father figures who kind of were performing that duty, right? Of I'm a trusted person, the Tucker Carlson effect, or what do you want to call it? You know, so maybe it's always been some heavy element of cult of personality, you know, wrapped in maybe this objectivity or whatever, and just the cult of personalities have changed, but maybe we are just, you know, as a species or whatever, doomed to want that, you know, patriarchal, matriarchal guidance in our life.
Yeah, I don't know. I think one thing that is tough to analyze and predict or understand is the impact that certain galvanizing personalities have on the public. We can sort of say why we think people love Trump or why we think people love Obama, why we think people love, you know, loved Bill Clinton or loved Richard Nixon. But it's, you know, it's very tough to fully put a finger on what it is about these individuals that really motivates people. You know, it is obvious that there's a large group of people that decided they really like and support Donald Trump in a way that they didn't other more conventional candidates and politicians who seem to have many fewer of the negatives elements that Trump had, the, you know, felony convictions and paying off a porn star and having a university that was found to be fraudulent. And, you know, there's so many things in his past that would have normally sort of destroyed a more conventional politician's career. But people decided that they liked Trump and they're willing to shrug all those things off. And, you know, I also think that is something that Democrats have struggled with. When they come up with a politician like Bill Clinton or Barack Obama who is able to inspire a lot of loyalty and a huge following among Democrats, those presidents have a hard time developing coattails. They have a hard time figuring out how to bring along other people to continue that legacy. So, you know, Clinton was not able to do it with Al Gore or even his wife, Hillary. You know, Barack Obama was not really able to do it with Joe Biden or Hillary Clinton, who lost to Trump. You know, it's just one of those things. You know it when you see it. You know a dynamic personality when you see it. You know someone who can draw others to him or her when you see it. And then when you don't see it, it is really hard to sort of create that excitement factor. And, you know, some might argue that was the problem that Kamala Harris had, was that she didn't quite have that extra level of charisma that some of the biggest political stars have.
I want to finish up by kind of wrapping what we've talked about and bringing it back to local. You've had a front row seat, you know, at the St. Pete Times, Tampa Bay Times, Poynter Institute, to the ebbs and flows of local news. And so where does local play into these, you know, social media, Fox News, CNN, juggernauts? Our attention seems to have gone away from our local communities and partly, I think that's the attention experience just was better on social media. You know, what can local news or what local news represented as a glue for a community, what can we do to get that back? Or do we need to get it back?
Well, it'd be nice if we could have it back. I mean, one of the things, there's a few different things that have happened. As the economic engine has sort of fallen out of the newspaper business, we've seen local newspapers diminish. You know, the Tampa Tribune first got bought by the Tampa Bay Times and then it kind of went away. The Tampa Bay Times itself is, you know, a much smaller enterprise than it was when I first started working there in 1995. And, you know, when the newspaper industry was kind of at its apex, when I came here in 1995 and the Tampa Tribune and the St. Petersburg Times were in intense competition with each other, they had huge newsrooms that were in communities all over the Tampa Bay area, and they were generating reporting that was then also filling up local TV, news broadcasts, and also radio. WFLA, for example, the AM radio station that, you know, had used to feature a lot of news. So those newspapers were kind of like the bedrock, the foundation of a whole local news structure that was built around taking the initiative and the initial reporting and the revelations of these gigantic newsrooms employed by these newspapers, and then turning that into TV and radio and all these other things. So when newspapers kind of diminish and they lay people off, you know, they disappear, then all of the reporting that they provided also disappears. And they're not alone. Of course, you know, radio stations were also downsized a lot, as were local TV stations. They were downsized a lot. So you get to the point where the news product that's being presented to the audience doesn't have as much local content, because there just aren't enough local reporters to go to every county commission meeting, or go to every school board meeting, or go to every city council meeting and come back with stories that can inform people about what's happening in their community. And in some places, people have been lucky enough to have very small platforms kind of arise that are very focused on their local community. But most places don't have that. So people don't know what's happening in their local communities, because all this news infrastructure that was built up to tell them what was happening has all kind of fallen away. It's all been cut back. It's all kind of disappeared. And so local political contests are not so much about local issues anymore, because it's hard for people to even get information about these local issues anymore. So they all become nationalized. So, you know, we have races for school board, we have races for city council, we have races for county commission, where the things the candidates are talking about are these national issues. They're talking about immigration, they're talking about abortion laws, they're talking about things that are really happening in Congress or happening in the White House or happening in the Supreme Court. Because if you try to talk about some sort of controversy involving the Pinellas County School District, well, how many people have even heard about it? How many people know the details of it? How many people have seen any reporting that tells them what that issue might be or how it might affect their vote? And so, you know, the disappearance of this news infrastructure has a tremendous impact on what people know about what's happening in their local communities and how they talk about local politics. And again, you know, I mean, one way out of it is that places like the Knight Foundation, for example, are providing millions of dollars across the country to, you know, fledgling news outlets in order to encourage them to expand their efforts and increase how they inform their communities. So, you know, the Knight Foundation announced a round of $20 million in grants a few months ago. And, you know, Watermark in Orlando and the Independent Alligator in Gainesville, they got significant amounts of money, hundreds of thousands of dollars, I do believe, to help them. And so there are some foundations and there are some philanthropies and there are some, you know, people out there trying to figure out how to rebuild that local news infrastructure so people have a better idea of what's going on in their local communities. But it's very difficult. It costs a lot of money. And it's not clear yet whether there's a way to expand those efforts in a way that's economically sustainable, because the economic engine of regional newspapers is so badly damaged. You know, we're in the middle of a lot of change, and a lot of it is fueled by technology. And, you know, part of, I think, what every news consumer has to kind of wrestle with is that with all this extra ability, we have all this ability to tap into information from all these different sources now and hear about things. You know, as a fan of music, I'm to the point now where I hear about a concert tour, and it used to be when I was a kid, you know, I heard that, you know, the Police were going to go on tour and it was going to be their final tour. And so I got together with my friends and we bought tickets to see the Police's last tour as a band at Comiskey Park in Chicago many years ago. Well, now when I hear about something like that, I can go on YouTube and somebody who went to the first show will have the whole show taped on their phone and then uploaded to YouTube. So when I heard about this tour called the Beat Tour with, you know, alum from the 80s era of King Crimson, recreating the stuff from those legendary progressive rock records, I wanted to figure out if I wanted to try and go see it when it came to Ruth Eckert Hall. So I just went on YouTube and I saw people who had put up video of previous performances in California, I think. And I could see what the band sounded like. And I was like, okay, this sounds interesting. I might want to see that live. And then I wound up buying a ticket. But what I might also have decided was, you know, my curiosity is kind of satisfied. Mm-hmm. I don't need to actually go see the show. I see what the band looked like. So we're at a point now where when I'm curious about what a band sounds like on the road, I can go on YouTube and I'll find a video and I'll see what that band sounds like in an instant. And it's that way with all kinds of information. And so, but with all of that ability and bounty comes the responsibility for the consumer to be more careful about what they consume and to try to make sure that they've done the best they can to make sure that what they're consuming is true before they go around believing it and before they go around talking about it to friends or passing it on to other people. Because what we know from polls is that people are much more likely to believe what a friend tells them or what a relative tells them or what someone they trust passes along to them rather than somebody like me, a professional journalist who spends every day figuring out how to vet information. So it puts more of the responsibility on the consumer who is consuming podcasts and media to be a little more careful about what you take in, a little more skeptical about what it's telling you, and make sure that you've done what you can do to find out whether or not it's valid before you transmit it on to someone else.
Yeah, and to your point, the trickiest part is you watch something that's misinformation twice, you've now trained the algorithm, and all they're going to do is feed you more of it. And so it's all of a sudden you're like, well, I've seen this 10 different places, when in reality it's just a keyword regurgitated over and over to you.
Exactly. But the interesting thing about those algorithms is that if you break the pattern and you seek out something that's different, it will suddenly start feeding you that thing that's different. So you just have to be aware that when you're on TikTok, when you're on YouTube, when you're on Twitter, there is an algorithm that is figuring out what kind of messages to make sure that you see first. And then you just figure out how to subvert that algorithm and how to teach it to feed you the things that you want to see or that you need to see, that you should be seeing, rather than the things it wants you to see. So once again, you know, like I give these talks and I quote the Spider-Man comic book, you know, with great power comes great responsibility. You know, Peter Parker's Uncle Ben told him that. And it is true. We have great power as media consumers now, but with that comes responsibility. And trying to get people to accept that responsibility and just understand a little bit of media literacy so they can vet some of this messaging before they buy it hook, line, and sinker. That has been the biggest challenge, I think, of the last few years.
A challenge we'll continue to work to face.
There we go.
Eric Deggans, thank you, sir.
Thank you.